Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Welcome to the Damcasters, brought to you in association with the Pima Air and Space Museum. I'm your host, Matt Bell. Dr. Kit Chapman is a science historian down at Falmouth University and one of my old muckers from History Hack, fantastic podcast run by Alex Churchill. Now, Kit is an incredibly clever chap, and what Kit does very well is explain complex things simply. And today we're going to be talking about nuclear testing, because that's a big subject that he brings to life, as you're going to hear in the episode, in an incredible way. And we're going to be looking at the IV Mike test in November 1952, which was the first detonation of a hydrogen bomb, a thermonuclear device. And to understand just what the heck was going on after the explosion, the United States flew fighters into the mushroom cloud to gather samples and understand just what was in there. As you can imagine, it was a bold plan that didn't quite go to plan, and there were some tragic consequences for it as well. So in this episode, we're going to be looking at what a thermonuclear device is, how big these things are when they go off, and what happened when F-34G Thunder jets flew into a mushroom cloud. As always, please do stick around for the middle of the pod, where we will be regaling you with one of the helicopters involved in today's episode as we visit the Pima Air and Space Museum, who are our fabulous sponsor for this pod. But we have to get straight into this, and immediately I'm going to start with some silly questions because I didn't do that well in science and I need Kit to help. Right. So what I normally do is do like a recorded intro and outro afterwards once we've talked, so that it's not like History Hack where we start one thing and go off and something else. How do you want to be introduced is the first question.
Dr. Kit Chapman, science historian based at Falmouth University.
Super. Cool. Right. Well, this is where I get to do my best role and play the idiot. So we're going to be talking about big bombs. And I guess the thing is, when we are looking at, and with, of course, the Fallout trailer dropping the other day, which we're all excited for TV and half-decent Bethesda game sort of things, when we're talking about atomic and nuclear weapons, we do have quite a wide variety of them. So we're going to be talking about the IV tests and Mike in particular, but what is the difference between a nuclear fusion bomb and then, say, one of the bombs that was dropped on Japan, which would have been a thermonuclear fission bomb, if my Googling was correct?
Wouldn't be thermonuclear. Thermonuclear is Ivy Mike.
Aha, see, there
it
we
would
go.
Be a fission bomb, though.
Okay.
So let's start with basically how these bombs work. Mm. So you've basically got a core, and what you're trying to do is you're trying to explode individual atoms. Now, when you explode an atom, that's fission, and basically you're releasing a lot of energy. If anyone knows any equation in physics, it's E equals mc squared. So C squared is the speed of light squared, which is an absolutely massive number. M is mass and E is energy. And so even though the mass of a single atom going apart is tiny, because the speed of light squared is so big, you're getting a lot of energy. Mass times the speed of light squared. So one uranium atom exploding is enough energy to shake a grain of sand. But we're not talking about one atom exploding. What we use is called fissile material, and they send out neutrons, particles, and they hit other atoms, and those atoms explode, and so on and so on. They release more neutrons, they explode. And what you get is a chain reaction where you're causing multiple atoms to explode. That's more energy, and that becomes enough to level a city. So the first bomb, which is Trinity Test, that was done 16th of July 1945, that is actually a plutonium bomb that they're using. Plutonium is a little bit heavier than uranium, and that means you've got a bigger mass, you've got a bigger bang. The first drop bomb that's used in anger is uranium because it's much simpler to make it go boom. Mm-hmm. Plutonium requires you to compress it. Uranium, you can just fire in a neutron and off it goes. So here it's showing me that is a uranium bomb. Plutonium, it's a slightly bigger bomb. That's Nagasaki. Now we're talking in terms of the amount of energy released in tons of TNT equivalent. So if you imagine 1 ton of TNT going off, that causes a certain level of boom. For a nuclear bomb, we're talking in kilotons. So Hiroshima, Nagasaki, we're looking around 10 to 15 kilotons, 10 to 15,000 tons of TNT going off. When we get to Ivy Mike, this is when we start going into thermonuclear bombs. And the actual difference is, I mean, I can go into the design a bit later on. The key thing is trying to get more of those atoms to explode, because these bombs are incredibly inefficient. Not enough of them are going up. And so you want more and more of the atoms to explode. The more you can do that, the more energy is being released. We also start getting fusion. That's when atoms are joining together. And that releases even more energy, which is why fusion reactors are going to be so important. And you start getting that happening in these thermonuclear weaponry. We use isotopes, heavier versions of hydrogen for this, which is why they're also known as hydrogen bombs. And when we do those, we get up into the megatons, millions of tons equivalent of TNT. So that's roughly the differences.
You've got a bomb big enough to level a city. What was the argument to go to hydrogen for this? Because this is the Oppenheimer-Teller argument,
yeah,
isn't it?
This is the classical Oppenheimer-Teller thing. So Oppenheimer's point was, what is the point of having a bomb that can already level a city? Why do you need a bigger one? Edward Teller is a Hungarian scientist. He flees the Axis, moves over to America. He is the real driving force of this. So much so that he actually creates his separate lab, Lawrence Livermore, outside Livermore in California, just for him to kind of play around with. And he is really pushing for bigger, bigger booms. And his argument is, no one wants to mess with someone who's got millions of tons of TNT. You know, it's strategic. But you're absolutely right. At the point, by the end of the 1940s, the bombs we've got are enough to wipe out any city on the planet. What is the point of making a larger one? Teller's argument, you know, is because it's terrifying, and it absolutely is, as we'll get into. But I personally don't see the reason for having thermonuclear weaponry.
No, and I completely agree with you. It's, you know, within the space of 10 years, we've gone from the dream of precision to the dream of destroying an entire city with one weapon, which is madness. I have a few questions before we get into Ivy Mike in particular. And one is what we're going to be talking about today, which is the sampling bit. Mm. And in some of the material you sent me, the interesting thing was after the Trinity test, they struggled to test what was actually there, and they were having to do crater sampling. So what was limiting about driving into a crater after a nuclear bomb's gone off and picking up what's left, to what they were then going to be trying to do when they move the testing out of the States and into the Pacific? What are they trying to find? Is this just because they don't know what's going to be there, or they're looking for something particular?
So there's a combination of things there. The first is when these bombs start going off, Trinity Test is the first one, as we mentioned. That's in New Mexico, White Sands. And when it goes off, We've got airplanes circling around. You've got B-29 bombers sort of observing the blast. People are taking photos of it. And as you're right, people drive down to the crater and they have a look at where the bomb's gone off and they try and work out the yield. How big was this bomb? And that's only one data point. It's not all of the data points because you've also got to think about where's all this matter gone and what's gone up into the stem. How much has it gone on? How much new neutrons are flying around in there? How much fission did we have? How much fusion did we have? How effective was this bomb in exploding all of the plutonium that we had in the core? We need to work all of that out. And you can do that better if you've got multiple data points and you've got data points of the stuff going up into the sky. So you want to know how much it's worked. There's a term they use in there called fractionation, which I won't go into, but basically they're exploring how effective the bomb is. The other thing is there are weird things that we get when nuclear bombs go off. So there's a material called trinitite, which never existed on Earth before we set off this bomb. Trinitite is basically a green glassy substance that exists when the nuclear bomb blast is so powerful, it turns the sand of the desert into green glass. Highly radioactive green glass. It's illegal to, you can now go to the Trinity site, it is illegal to take trinitite off the site. You know, people will check for it and make sure that you're not nicking stuff off. So there's all of that going on. But
why would you want to nick a bit of private radioactive glass?
So there's two really interesting things about the trinitite. One is that that people do sell it and people do collect this, you know, bomb memorabilia, for want of a better word. The other thing is that ants, for some reason, are crazily attracted to it. Mm. And so they used to have to go around and try and find ants' nests using Geiger counters to collect samples of trinitite because the ants would start hoarding it.
Wow.
Which, you know, when we talk about fallout and, you know, imagine these giant ants emerging. We're not entirely sure why ants do that. So there's all of these interesting questions. The other thing that we don't understand is what's going off into the clouds. We didn't know anything about radiation and radiation protection. We didn't know about electromagnetic pulse when we started these tests, which becomes very important later on. And we're hoping that there is fusion. So while most of the energy will be fission, breaking apart, occasionally you will get fusion in a nuclear bomb. And a nuclear bomb is pretty much the same as a nuclear reactor in that respect. Most of the time you're getting fission, sometimes you're getting fusion. It's how we make plutonium. And if you do that, you're making elements heavier than plutonium, which start to be things that do not exist naturally on Earth. You know, the next ones are americium and curium. You cannot find americium and curium anywhere on Earth except they've been specifically made in nuclear reactors or in nuclear bombs. And at this point in time, we're only up to californium, which is element 98. Plutonium is element 94. So we're four elements up. If we can go even further than that, we can find elements that do not exist on Earth and we've never found before. And there are many reasons we want to do that.
See your first book for more on
absolutely that. See Super Heavy by Kit Chapman for more details.
this is where I'm looking up, think I should have grabbed it and had it to refer to as we're going through some of this. As my science teachers will tell you, this was not one of my better subjects.
I think you're keeping up, you're doing fine.
Yeah, thank goodness I'm just asking the questions. So one of the big shifts is moving out to the Pacific, moving these detonations. One of the things that always fascinates me is just how many tests they did in Nevada, because it's a remarkable number of explosions.
Yeah, absolutely. There are whole programs of testing, multiple programs of testing in Nevada. And of course, Las Vegas becomes a destination because people want to go and watch the mushroom clouds. That's how Las Vegas got its break.
Yeah, put everything on black and then watch a blinding flash on the horizon. So let's start talking. I suppose before we get onto that, what does an atoll do better than a desert? Is it just because it's remote and it's there, or can you actually collect better data if you're out in the middle of the ocean?
Yes, there is security. So a desert, nice and secure. An atoll, you know, hundreds of miles away from anyone else, is incredibly secure. Mm-hmm. You know, this is basically the most secure place you can find it. But of course, it is incredibly remote as well, which creates all kinds of logistics problems for the United States and other countries. So there is an aspect there. Another part of it is while the desert might be where you're setting off the bomb, a wind will drag that radioactive cloud over to cities, and people might start falling ill. And the last thing the US government wants is to have a population that's ill and then suing them for enormous amounts of money. So the wind effects are something they're concerned about. An atoll also is a fantastic harbour for shipping. Right? I mean, it's almost a perfect harbour in the middle of the ocean. So you can use that as a staging post very neatly. And if you want to experiment what happens when a ship is destroyed or bombed by nuclear weaponry, you've got that capability as well. So there are several big tick boxes for atolls. The final thing that you can do, which is really quite simple, is that when the bomb goes off, as I mentioned, there's going to be all kinds of debris and stuff going up in the cloud. There is simply more random stuff in a desert than there is in an ocean. We know what the ocean's made of. You know, so apart from some of the coral, that's a really good reason to do it in an atoll as well.
So we're heading out to the Pacific for this, and the name of the atoll is one of those fantastic names which I can never pronounce.
It's Eniwetak.
Eniwetak. You see, that's why I've got you here. So what are the hopes for the test? Because this is the first test of a hydrogen bomb.
Yep.
So this is Teller's moment. He's won the argument. And they've headed out to the Western Pacific.
Yeah, so this is part of the Marshall Islands. Mm-hmm. The best way to think of it is if you draw a line north of New Zealand and sort of east from the Philippines, where those lines intersect, that's where we're doing it.
Fantastic. I shall put something up. So that's that's it. Because it's terribly remote. It's, you know, it's they're having to cover. I remember watching the Ivy Mike original test film, which is weird. It's like absolutely nuts.
Yeah, and if you've seen any Godzilla movie, that's the bit they always play at the start.
Yeah. Yep,
it's that big sort of mushroom cloud blooming out.
Yes. So, funnily enough, I was watching Godzilla clips earlier. Don't ask me why. So, what are the hopes for this test? What are they wanting to do besides, finding out that this thing works? What are the sort of requirements that they're wanting to get out of this test?
So the number one is making sure it works. So up until that point, thermonuclear weaponry and this idea of hydrogen bombs, completely theoretical. And the actual design of the bomb has only emerged in the past, you know, 6-7 months, really. It's Teller and a guy called Stanislaw Ulam working together. So it's a Teller-Ulam device. And it is something that they've never done before. They're not entirely sure that this works. So much so that the next test along, which is Ivy King, they do something completely different because they actually they're not sure that this is going to actually have any effect. So they're trying out something new. And the key part of Ivy Mike is how they've actually designed the bomb, this Ulam Teller device. So it's a two-part mechanism. You've got your classic atomic bomb, and I say that in as if I have any idea how these things are constructed. It is still incredibly classified how these bombs actually work, but we know roughly how it goes. So
not something you can Google or just watch Oppenheimer and make in your backyard. Then.
Absolutely, so people have a pretty good idea. Let's put it that way, but there are little quirks that we're not entirely sure with. So the key part is you've got your standard sort of core, and that's the bit that goes off first. When that detonates, it's sending out thermal X-rays at about 100 million, I was going to say 100 million Kelvin. It could be 100 million degrees C as well, because you know we're on roughly the same schedule. 100 million degrees C firing out, and they fire down into what's called the spark plug of plutonium. So there's this tube of plutonium surrounded by liquid deuterium, which is heavy hydrogen, and that is reaching it in about 1 millisecond and giving you 50 kilotons of energy pushing through that tube. This is so much energy that the X-rays actually have weight. The radiation actually weighs something. And so you get this massive condensing, this super densities, even before the shockwave and the actual explosion of all the fission particles happens. And because of that, you are getting a more complete bang. You are getting an even more complete fission, but you're also, because of the way that the deuterium is there. The deuterium is there as fuel for fusion. So you're getting this huge complete fission, and then you're getting fusion as well. And this two-stage kind of idea means that the bomb is just huge. I mean, it's the biggest thing that has ever been detonated on the planet at that point in 1952.
So that was going to be my next bit. When are we, and how far after the Russians detonating their first weapon are we talking about? Because this is all sort of playing into the same sort of race here, aren't we?
It is. So the Russians detonating their first weapon, that's first lightning, that's 1949. We are talking November 1952 for the United States, detonating thermonuclear weapons.
So we're taking it up a notch, but we also have all of that paranoia of the surprise that somebody else has this thing as well in such a short period.
Yeah, and to be honest with you, it wasn't too much of a surprise that the Russians would eventually get there. I mean, unfortunately, a lot of the stuff in the Manhattan Project was leaked. We later found out how it was leaked. Various spies. Fuchs was probably the most famous one of them. I think he's even in the movie Oppenheimer. It wasn't too much of a shock that the Russians actually eventually got there. But almost immediately afterwards, we're talking less than 2 years, well, less than 3 years later, the United States is upping the game and going from kilotons to megatons, tens of thousands to millions of tons of TNT. And this is the classic one-upmanship that you see throughout the Cold War. It's terrifying. The one thing to bear in mind with this particular test, it is incredibly experimental. The point of Ivy Mike isn't to have a bomb that you could drop on someone else. You couldn't drop the Ivy Mike bomb on someone else. The main reason for that is that it is absolutely bloody massive. deuterium is a terrible, terrible thing to have to deal with, because to keep it liquid, you have to basically cryogenically freeze it. And so we have got, we are literally nuking the fridge in this one. We have got a giant 20-foot-long, 7-foot-wide cryo chamber with a thermonuclear bomb in the middle of it. And that is what Ivy Mike is all about.
So we're going to get onto the aviation bit of this podcast, ladies and gentlemen, if you're actually wondering when we're going to get to that. Because this is where we start getting into the need for atomic cloud sampling. Mm. And this is where we have incredibly brave, borderline nuts pilots flying into mushroom clouds, essentially. That's what we're talking about, isn't it?
That is exactly what we have. We have, and I was saying to this just before the podcast, that it astonishes me that we often sort of hyperbolize and say, you know, this person is doing one of the most dangerous things you can imagine. These people are literally flying fighter jets into a nuclear bomb. That is what they are doing. How did it come about? There's quite a long history of it. So I mentioned Trinity had B-29s orbiting around it. And the B-29 was, as we know, the most expensive project in the Second World War for the Americans. It had specialized modified bombers developed during the initial testing in 1943, specifically so that it could drop nuclear weapons. It was always sort of part and parcel of it. So these B-29s were orbiting. Very famous physicists were also on board those B-29s. Luis Alvarez was at the Trinity site on a B-29. But the question was, how do you actually find out what's inside? Because I mentioned you need those data points. So you need to get something inside that cloud to work out what's going on. And the first thing they used was unmanned drones. Nice and safe. So B-17s, F-6s, I think it was. And they often crashed, couldn't get decent samples whatsoever, even if they were, because they didn't know where they were flying to. So they then started using, interesting little story. So there's a chap called Paul Fackler. And Paul Fackler does something that you and I probably think is a bit bonkers. We're during Zebra, which is the final of the sandstone tests, 1940s, and Fackler is one of the pilots that is orbiting around the nuclear mushroom cloud. He's been told not to go inside because we don't know what's going to happen. And a little spur from the mushroom cloud comes out, and Fackler claims he cannot dodge out the way in a B-29. There is huge debate to this day whether he did this intentionally or not, but he flies through the mushroom cloud. He then It's in his report that he then flies through a couple of rain clouds to wash down his B-29. you're sort of groaning, rolling your eyes, of course.
Those convenient rain clouds in the desert.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And then nobody died. Nobody got sick. It was absolutely fine. And he landed. So people go, actually, this is a really good idea. Let's actually fly manned planes into nuclear mushroom clouds. B-29s are used. There is a B-29 called the Overexposed, which I love the name of.
It's on the nose, even for pilots and aircraft.
I know. They're not about subtlety, are they? I'm just trying to remember what the name of the Necessary Evil was one of the bombers on Nagasaki. I mean, some of them are really kind of on the nose. Anyway, they then think about, well, why don't we use
there's the famous image of the downed airman that's got murder ink painted on the back of his jacket as well. Subtlety's not a strength of pilots and aircraft.
Not like today. I mean, that's the other thing. It's sort of completely reversed in that all these... every time I watch Top Gun Maverick, I was just trying to imagine how you got the nickname Maverick. Because, as I can say, no pilot I've ever known has had a polite nickname. Anyway.
See our interview with Kim, who had the nickname Killer Chick. So, you know, it's all good. Anyway, sorry. Back to you, mate.
We're moving on. So they try F-80s, and they're called Q-F-80s because they use chimpanzees. But this is where we get into the problem. EMP, as I mentioned, electromagnetic pulse, is something that you get when a nuclear bomb goes off. And the chimpanzees didn't know what to do, and the chimps all crashed and died. So eventually we start getting into human testing, and there's huge problems with B-29s. They are big bombers. They are not particularly fast, and you want to get in and get out as fast as you can. And there are multiple crew members on board, and so you're increasing the number of people who are potentially exposed to radiation. So they start using fighters, T-33s, you've got the F-84s, all kinds of stuff being used. Eventually, they do settle on the Thunderjet, though.
Which is something I need to do something more on, because the Thunderjet's great. It's big Republic ground attack aircraft. It's already a bit of a beast. And so it's a clever choice to do. But I suppose one of the things that was interesting reading about it was all the other types of aircraft that they were trying to get their hands on. That yeah. LeMay was... Yeah,
which you can imagine.
Because what have we got on the list? We've got the B-36, which is the big Convair... insane, massively big bomber thing, which is even slower than everything else. Why would you want that? B-47s, fast bomber, smaller crew, which is pretty good. B-45, which is that sort of nuts, almost like a Cambery sort of thing as well. But LeMay's not having any of it, is it? So they're having to resort to fighters.
So he nixes all of this like 6 months out, saying, no, I need it for Strategic Air Command. We're not having that. You can't have these planes. F-89s, F-94s, they haven't got the ceiling because we know that this bomb is going to be high. And so we fall onto the F-84 Thunderjet. One of the reasons is it's a jet, so it's moving a lot faster than a prop plane. And bear in mind, again, 1950s, jets still relatively new. F-84 by this point, it has been tested repeatedly in the Korean War. It's worth mentioning that initially it was a bit of a lemon when it came to a plane, but I think that by the time of the F-84G, they've got everything sort of more or less sorted out. You can refuel in flight, which is incredibly important when you're over the Pacific. There's an ejection seat. It's got anti-G, which is goodness knows what's going on in that mushroom cloud. Transfer of fuel automatically, and it can be modified very, very easily because if anyone who's ever seen one of these, you've got it's a long cigar-shaped body, and then you've got your flat wings. Some of them did have slanted wings. Boney's looking at me like I'm some sort of heathen.
Swept, my dear man, swept.
Yes. These ones have got long, flatty wings. And then they've got sort of cigar-shaped fuel pods at the end. And these fuel pods are fantastic for atomic sampling because you can just take the fuel out of them and you can put all your gizmos and gadgets in there. And we've got Geiger counters. We have got temperature gauges. We've got electronic distortion equipment. We have got basically everything you could imagine to detect what is going on in there. And we've also just got lovely little nets and filters. And these filters can just scoop up whatever nonsense is in your mushroom cloud and come, bring it back to base, and you can analyze it. The F-84 Thunderjet is perfect for this kind of work.
So the filters and the collection things that they're bolting onto the wings of the Thunderjets are essentially just big scoops. We're not talking anything particularly fancy. They're just trying to collect, because they don't know what's there. They're just going to be collecting everything that goes through.
Yeah, the best way I could describe it is like, it's like a pool filter. Okay? So it's just whatever's flowing through there, it's going to gather it up and it's going to catch it. And it's really nothing more complicated than that. The actual sensor equipment, as I mentioned, there are several other sensors for things like radiation and temperature. And that does mean that you've got multiple gauges. So these pilots went through a series, I mean, it's 16 different training programs and missions that they end up going on before they're even allowed to be part of testing. Because they are not just flying a craft through a nuclear bomb. And bear in mind, that is not easy. There is a lot of turbulence in there. But you're also monitoring multiple gauges simultaneously while you're doing that. You're activating the collection because you've got little doors on them. You've got to open those up and actually scoop them. And of course, watching what you're doing in terms of fuel and everything else that's going on. So this is an incredibly difficult job. This is not something that's easy. And also, you've got to be, I think, a little bit bonkers to want to fly into a nuclear bomb.
A little bit. What sort of kit were these guys given? Because they don't know what they're going to be flying into, but they're going to know that it's a lot of radiation. Were the aircraft modified with lead, or were they given anything to try to help them in any way?
Yeah, they were. So there's multiple things that sort of go on in terms of minimizing radiation risk. When they're actually on the ground and they're removing the samples, it's done by guys called decon grunts, decontamination grunts. And they are actually collecting things with a 10-foot pole. They're literally, you know, not touching the aircraft. The pilots have to be trained to get out of the aircraft once it's landed and not touch the sides so they don't get any radiation. But they are given some basic equipment. They are given lead-lined gloves and lead-lined jackets, which the idea is to obviously protect against radiation. Lead is a fantastic protector against radiation, particularly when we get beyond alpha. So alpha radiation, you can block with a piece of paper, very, very easy. Beta, gamma, a little bit more difficult. And this is the idea of trying to keep them alive. What it doesn't do, and they don't have, is any kind of protection through their breathing equipment, which is something that the US was aware of and they were concerned about. And of course, later on, it would emerge that many of them would develop cancers later in life.
We'll come back to that. And let's talk about the test itself, because this is not a few guys on an atoll with a very big bomb, as you said.
No, this is
a lot of kit dedicated to this test. Yeah. How big are we talking here?
I mean, we're talking 9,500 military personnel, 2,300 civilians. We're talking a small city. We're talking the size of, you know, an average attendance at Crowan Cottage.
Oh, that's a bit harsh. It's more than that now, my dear chap.
The bomb itself, 74 tons. And most of that is cryogenics, as I mentioned. You've got all that. But you've also got the sampling equipment and multiple stations around. They're creating artificial causeways to link the islands on the atoll, because it's a series of little islands. The bomb is actually going to go off on a place called Ujilab, which will be important later on. And so there is just, I mean, the circus is suddenly arriving on this remote atoll at the very end of the Marshall Islands. It is a huge program. And so they've got to build runways down there so the planes can take off. And bear in mind, anyone who knows anything about the F-84, it's renowned for having a long takeoff. You know, you need a massive strip. There is all kinds of work going on.
So we're going to have new air bases. We're going to have reasonably short-ranged aircraft. F-84 is massively underpowered. That's why air refueling was so important for it. one of the things that was in those old documents was a lot on the command and control. So they are putting a lot in place to ensure that outside of the blast range, the aircraft can be refueled, can loiter, can get in, get out, refuel again, and return home.
We've got electric beacons, we've got refuelers, we've got command and control from a B-29, we have got command and control from Navy as well. So there are multiple ships in the area. They're about 40 kilometers off the bomb site. It is a coordinated investigation, scientific investigation conducted by US Army, US Air Force, US Navy, US intelligence. This is, you know, sort of cooperation between the forces writ large. It is not just a bomb's going off and a couple of air people are flying around. It's far more elaborate than that.
Was there any idea for the crews what they were going to be going into? We sort of talked about the sort of skimming the edges of the earlier tests, but was this really a case of, you know, the classic Blackadder gag about, you know, here's your map, fill it in as you go sort of thing? are we sort of speaking that, or did they have any idea about what they were about to get into?
I mean, the answer is yes and no. So did they have an idea about what they're testing? Yes, because obviously, as we mentioned, Nevada test sites, people have already started flying into nuclear bombs at this point. Mm. You know, we have got experience of people going into that environment. No, because no one has ever set off a thermonuclear device. We just have no concept of how big this is going to be. And that becomes really, really important when the bomb actually goes off, because all of the plans they had, it was a very neat plan. So they would have three flights, red, white, and blue. Red would head off about 90 minutes after the detonation, fly in, and you're going through the top of the mushroom cloud at the plan. Fly out, refuel with the destroyer, over the destroyer. They would sample by flying into the cloud and then fly back to base. There's a beacon so they can find their way in the Pacific. Really nice, easy. White would be 3 hours after the blast. Blue would be 4.5 hours. So that was the plan. The problem is that when the bomb goes off, that plan suddenly seems rather amateurish compared to what they need.
So let's talk about when the bomb goes off. So what's the date? 1st of November 1952.
1st of November 1952. Back in the US, it is Halloween, because bear in mind, we are across the international dateline. Test itself is 07:15 local time. And the bomb goes off. It is bigger than anyone has ever seen before. It is 10.4 megatons, 10.4 million tons equivalent of TNT. This is a blast that unlike the world has ever seen.
What were they expecting, I suppose?
They didn't know. I mean, and bear in mind,
so they hadn't done any rough back of the fag packet sort of calculations.
The problem with the back of the fag packet calculations is that they're so varied. So they didn't even know this bomb was going to work. Bear in mind, Ivy King, as I mentioned, is a fission device, a classic fission device. It's huge. It's about 500 kilotons. But it's just not in the same league as Ivy Mike. But I always think about the Trinity test and the night before. And Enrico Fermi, a very famous scientist, was going around soldiers taking bets on how big the blast would be. And he was telling the personnel who didn't know anything about science that there was a good probability the sky would catch fire and the entire world would burn. Which is, you know, lovely, friendly, cheery thought to hear from one of your lead scientists. So, you know, Edward Teller had predictions, Oppenheimer had predictions, and we were ranging from not even kilotons right up to sort of 15 kilotons. There was a massive variation with Trinity. The truth is, while we had a rough idea, hoped it would be megatons with Teller, no one was entirely certain. But, you know, 10.4 million tons equivalent of TNT, that is one heck of a blast. And 77% of that, you know, about good three quarters, that is fission. That is the classic fission explosion. 25% of it, give or take, that's fusion. So we've got a huge blast there. It is so successful, Edward Teller, over a Halloween party in San Francisco that evening, he gets a seismic reading on his scales, and he knows the bomb has gone off. And he immediately telegraphs someone, it's a boy, even before news has reached America, because he's able to detect the seismic shift. To give you an idea of how big this bomb was, Sailors 40 kilometers away on the ship reported a heat of 180 Fahrenheit hitting them. Yeah, you're looking at me baffled. You know, we're looking in 50, 60 degrees Celsius suddenly hitting you. Trees are scorched at the edge of the atoll 17 miles away from this bomb. Ujilab, the island itself, I mean, this is one of those classic things. If you find Eniwetok Atoll on Google Maps, you can very easily try and guess where Ujilab is. It's that big blue circle where an island has very clearly been blown off the map. It literally does not exist anymore. There is just a hole, a dark blue hole. The mushroom cloud, it reaches 56,000 feet in 90 seconds. By the end of its moving up, it is 130,000 feet, the actual cloud. It is 100 miles wide, and the stem is 20 miles thick. You know, this is an explosion on a scale that you cannot possibly imagine unless you have seen it.
And of course, that's thrown all the plans out, because that's higher than the operational ceiling of the aircraft. They're already at the limits of their range, and they've suddenly got this thing which is ginormous sitting in front of them.
Absolutely. It just throws everything into chaos, because bear in mind, Red Flight, the first guys in, they're supposed to go in 90 minutes after detonation. So they're already flying out, they're already refueling, and now they're circling going, guys, should we be going in? What the hell are we doing? They're using up fuel that way. They're also faced with the prospect of, because the operational ceiling is higher than even the F-84 can go, they have to fly through the stem. They have no option. And so they are going to go through where all of the coral and the debris and the SpongeBob SquarePants bottom of the ocean stuff is, and that is the stem. So this is not just a matter of flying through radiation and intense heat and pockets of all kinds of nastiness and electromagnetic pulses. It is flying through clouds of debris and dirt. And this is very, very difficult for a early jet engine.
Be very difficult now.
It's bonkers that they even went in, but lo and behold, they did.
So we're going to get on to Red Flight now, talk about Virgil Moroney and that. But in that very weird fourth wall breaky documentary film that the Navy made, I'll put the link in the description. It's so weird. It's like literally us having a conversation and then a guy turning to the camera and going, "Now join us as we explode." It's freaky.
Yeah, and then you've got little bits that have been redacted still. Mm. So it's very clear they were saying even more stuff that you can't read. It's a fascinating document.
I whenever I watch those things, I always think that there was so many guys that must have been like writers from Hollywood in junior levels that have gotten sucked into national service and things. And they're working out a lot of things. But there's a helicopter flight as well, isn't there? That goes out to have a look to see what's there. Those guys, big balls, is all I have to say.
Yeah, I mean, flying a helicopter in 1952, probably big balls, to be perfectly honest. But you are now flying to where the greatest explosion has ever happened in human history.
Yeah. Go find the island that's not there
anymore. Yeah, go find the island that's not there. And they're going out there to find whether or not the island still exists. Mm. And surprise, surprise, it doesn't. The bomb casing, the buildings, the testing equipment, the causeways that they've built, there is just a big old hole in the ocean. And what do you do? You know, the only thing is to fly back.
We're going to take a quick break so that we can get the latest from the Pima Air and Space Museum with Head of Collections, Andrew Bowley.
Here we are at the Pima Air and Space Museum with one of our two Sikorsky Dragonflies. The Dragonfly was one of the first helicopters to go into service with the U.S. military, the Air Force, the Marines, and the Navy use them. This one was used by the Coast Guard. It was the first helicopter used by the Coast Guard. They were heavily used to kind of set up doctrine for search and rescue for the Coast Guard. So a lot of what went forward with more modern and powerful helicopters after this was all stuff that they learned using the Dragonfly. This one did do a stint on one of the Coast Guard icebreakers because they usually had helicopter support with those. It's interesting to take a look at these earlier helicopters that used World War II style piston engines. Like this one had a Pratt & Whitney R-98. So it limited a lot of the payload these types of helicopters could take. So it really was until you started having turbine engines in helicopters, like starting with helicopters like the Huey, that helicopters were actually able to start carrying larger amounts of troops and carry more equipment and more crew, weapons, etc. But this is one of the ones that started it all, like with the Bell and some of the other early helicopter designs.
To learn more about what is on display and what events are coming up at the Pima Air and Space Museum in Tucson, Arizona, please do check out their website at www.pimaair.org.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
And now, back to the show. So they're flying back. Moroni and Red Flight are going in. So Virgil Moroni is a very experienced pilot. He's a 9-victory ace on Republic's previous aircraft, the P-47, back in the Second World War.
Yeah, very good guy.
Yeah. Seriously, we'll put some links in about him. He had a fantastic and interesting, varied career.
Yeah, and then later on in the Vietnam War with his son as well. I think his son gets shot down in the Vietnam War.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think so, yeah. What happens when he starts flying into the cloud? What does he experience?
Okay, so Moroni, as we mentioned, incredibly experienced pilot, and he's flying in for about 5 minutes. I mean, he's not sticking around in there. He's flying in there, getting his stuff and flying out. Open up the wings. He describes that it's a red glow like the inside of a red-hot furnace inside this cloud. And the only thing that I can try and sort of give you a conjured picture of is sort of like, you know that bit in Flash Gordon when they're flying through those red clouds and it's all kind of, you know, the camp? It's like that, only real and hot and radioactive, and there's dust storms in there. It's a raging dust storm in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. So he's got three radiation instruments in his cockpit. He immediately responds, they sweep like the second hand on a watch. I mean, these things are just sort of going up and up and up and up. By 5 minutes, the radiation instruments hit the peg. They have hit the maximum. And he's like, I am out of here. He's got his wingman, which is Red 2, and they fly out of there. There is simply nothing more that they can possibly do. He breaks free of the SAM. He pairs up with his wingman, and he orders the next two in. And that's Bob Hagen in Red 3 and Jimmy Robinson in Red 4. And Moroni orders them very clearly, a final warning, don't go in too far. Because this is the most dangerous place on Earth.
So they're going in singly, or are they going in as pairs?
So they're going in as pairs. So as I say, paired up, red one and red two, and then you've got red three, red four. The problem is you cannot keep in formation when you are struggling to fly through the stem of a nuclear mushroom cloud. It's just not possible. And as we'll see for the second pair, not possible, even if they could have done that.
Yeah. And again, we've got two guys in Jimmy Robinson and Bob Hagen who are experienced. They've not selected rookies for this sort of thing. Things don't go as well for the second pair in, do they?
They don't. So Bob Hagen, as you mentioned, very experienced fighter pilot. Jimmy Robinson, very interesting career trajectory. He was actually on Liberators in the Second World War, and he was a bombardier. So he actually made the switch to become pilot and ended up becoming a fighter pilot. Moroni and Robinson were also prisoner of war veterans. So I can't remember where Moroni was shot down, but Robinson was shot down on a mission over Romania. So both of them had that experience as well.
Yeah, it was one. Robinson was on one of the Palesti raids, wasn't it? One of the low level jobbies. Yeah,
that's right. He was he was in Dazzling Duchess for bomber fans. Anyway, so they go in, and I mean, almost immediately, everything is exactly as Moroni's described it. You know, Hagen's and Hagen's response is very similar in terms of it's still red in here, it's still a furnace, and Robinson almost immediately runs into trouble. He has a pocket of radiation directly in front of him. He knows he has to avoid it. He makes a turn to do so, and he stalls. And suddenly, he is plummeting down to 20,000 feet by the time he recovers through a nuclear mushroom cloud, which I can only imagine is one of the most terrifying things. We do have some comments, heavy breathing, for example, because he was hitting his radio, struggling with the yoke, trying to get out of this stall. He does manage to do it. He manages to recover. They've got the data, and they immediately get out of the cloud. And Hagen and Robinson try and form up. They find each other. But the problem is, as I've mentioned, electromagnetic pulse, all of their detection equipment trying to find the beacon is scrambled. There is no sign of the refueling plane in sight. They just don't know where they are. And the mushroom cloud, by this point, as I said, it's spread over 100 miles. We've now got rain clouds moving in here. It's incredibly difficult to find anybody. And Hagen and Robinson, essentially, they are flying blind around the Pacific Ocean, trying to find some way to find their way home. It's just awful. They do eventually manage to pick up the beacon for the airfield at the end of Ujilab. Not Ujilab, anyway, attack. They do find it on Inuitak. Yeah, I was going to say, trying to land on Ujilab at that point would have been very difficult.
Very wet.
Yeah, very indeed. So they do find the landing strip, but by this point they are running on vapors. They just don't have any fuel. Hagen runs out of fuel pretty much as he hits the tarmac. He's going first. He actually bursts his tires on landing. He gets essentially a crash landing, but he's on the tarmac. He's on land. Robinson's following up, and Robinson is out of fuel. 3.5 miles out, he's basically gliding. He realizes he's not going to make it. He has two options at this point. He can either try and bail out, but the problem is he's already too low, or he can try and land in the sea. It looks like he tried the first one. First of all, he was going for it, and then he decided actually he was going to make a sea landing. The problem is that it doesn't go very well. So the rescue helicopter is basically rushing out to him as he lands. The problem is, as we've mentioned earlier, Robinson is wearing a lead-lined jacket. And if you land in the sea and, there isn't much you can really do for someone who's in a lead-lined jacket. So by the time the helicopter arrives there, there is nothing much more than his plane sinking, and they never find Jimmy Robinson's body.
But they are able to recover his samplers.
They are able to recover the samples from the craft. And there is some controversy as to whether or not it was from the samples of Jimmy Robinson as well that they managed to get. But I have spoken to people who know a little bit more about that particular test than the official records. And there is a suggestion that, yes, they were able to recover those filters.
Because of the nature of this test, Robinson's death, I don't want to say covered up, but he doesn't get a memorial in Arlington till many, many years later. One of those things that it's too secret to be able to talk about what actually happened.
It's also the big problem is less secrecy and more bureaucracy. So he is awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross almost immediately, which is presented to his widow a few years later. The problem with getting him a place at Arlington, and I'm glad to say that he does have a place now at Arlington. I've actually visited it. He gets his place in 2002, 50 years after this happened. The problem is that no one knows who this falls under, because at this point, everything is very much ad hoc. While we've got a lot of sort of test squadrons, things like that, and the 4925th Test Group Atomic from Special Weapons Command, 4926 Air Sampling Squadron isn't set up till the next year. And those are the ones that are going to carry on doing this. So it's a bureaucratic black hole. And that means that Jimmy Robinson does not get his place in Arlington Cemetery until the campaign of his daughter, Becky Miller, who is a wonderful lady. I've spoken to her. She does a lot of veterans work in 2002.
So what have they found? Because these guys have flown into hell on earth, or hell in the sky, I suppose, and they've captured a lot of stuff. And this is where elements 99 and 100 on your big chart come in.
Yes. So I mentioned earlier that fusion is basically moving one place up the periodic table. And I won't go into the hows and whys of it. It's about to do with protons, and this is an aviation podcast, and I'm sure you couldn't care less. One thing they've scooped up is plutonium-246. So this is an incredibly neutron-rich isotope of plutonium. Isotopes are basically variations of elements that have got more or less neutrons. This one's got loads and loads of neutrons. They calculate from that there must have been 10 to the 24 neutrons per square centimeter in that cloud, which is bonkers. I mean, that is just, you know,
that's a lot of zeros.
That is an awful lot of zeros. That is 10 to the 24, awful lot of zeros. I'm just trying to work out, is that a billion, trillion, trillion? So it's astronomical figure.
Lots.
And the scientists, that it comes back to Los Alamos, which is where they're doing the investigations. A sample of it also ends up at Berkeley. And Berkeley realizes very quickly that if you've got plutonium-246, you must also have plutonium-244. And plutonium-244 is a very weird isotope, because while plutonium doesn't exist naturally on Earth, it's got far too short a half-life, which I won't go into, but basically radioactively it breaks down. Plutonium-244 has a half-life of 80 million years, which means that theoretically, if you've got enough of it, it could be from the origins of the solar system. We could actually find some stuff. And later on, a scientist at Los Alamos does find some plutonium from the origins of the solar system in a different rock, in a meteorite. But we're getting off track. From that sample,
that sounds like a fun podcast to do. We'll come.
I was going to say it's completely separate, completely different thing. But we'll move on from that. The Berkeley team, Glenn Seaborg and Al Giorso, they are the guys that have discovered these americium and curium. The next ones after americium and curium are berkelium, californium. So it kind of gives you a hint of what they've been doing. And they realize that if you've got 10 to the 24 neutrons per square centimeter, you must, absolutely must have made americium, curium, berkelium, and californium, and then maybe the next one after that as well. What's beyond californium? We don't know. We haven't discovered it. That's element 99. And what? Maybe we made something even beyond that. That could be element 100. So they start getting samples and they start analyzing it with Los Alamos. There is a big hoo-ha over Christmas because various labs, everyone wants these samples. Everyone wants a bit of the filter. Everyone's claiming they found all kinds of stuff. In the end, Berkeley are able to partner with Los Alamos and they officially claim elements 99 and 100 from the samples gathered by Red Flight. So Jimmy Robinson has potentially become the first person who died discovering new elements. And the elements are named Einsteinium after Albert Einstein and Fermium after Enrico Fermi, who we've just mentioned. They're on the periodic table for the rest of time. These are the only two elements that have been discovered, to my knowledge, by airplanes or involving airplanes. And they are the only two elements that have been discovered by atomic bombs. But it is quite an astonishing legacy for people, incredibly brave people, who flew into a thermonuclear mushroom cloud.
So, ladies and gentlemen, when you think back to those chemistry lessons and things in the big chart on the wall, those ones in the bottom right corner. Bottom right corner?
Yeah, they'll be the bottom right, yeah.
Yeah. Were discovered by very brave men in interesting rickety Republic tactical fighter bombers flying into a mushroom cloud. Let's wrap up. When does all this get made public? Because I'm guessing the test itself would have been public reasonably soon. The discoveries, though, would have taken a while to get out.
Yeah, so the discovery. So as I mentioned, there is an academic bun fight, for want of a better reason.
Academic bun fight. You guys do that very well.
So that's going on in 1953. These elements actually start first appearing in 1955. So it's relatively soon. The reason is that the Swedish do a completely different approach, and they discover elements 99 and 100 and go, ha-ha, we found it, to which the Americans have to very tacitly sort of respond, we found it by other means, and we did it a couple of years earlier. To which point, everyone knows exactly what they're talking about. So, yes, Ivy Mike, you can't keep a secret. I mean, this is the one thing I always find hilarious about conspiracy theories about the moon landing. You cannot keep 10,000 people quiet. It's just not possible to do that. Everyone knows about the testing. Everyone knows what's going on. The thermonuclear device. There is no point having a thermonuclear device and not telling the Russians about it, because the whole point is to intimidate and scare the pants out of them. So they're very, very quickly revealed. The elements, as I mentioned, the discoveries, we're looking a couple of years, but everything is pretty much out in the open by 1955.
What happens to the crews? Because I was able to see that Maroney only makes it to 59 and dies of cancer in 1980. Yeah. I'm guessing that's a relatively common story for these chaps, because they must have been taking huge doses in those clouds.
It is one of the tragedies of the 20th century when we look back at what could have been done and the various things that really should never have happened. It's not the only place where we see that in nuclear development. The Hanford site is in Washington is notorious as probably the most nuclearly polluted place on the planet. It would take over $1 billion to clean up. People have developed cancers. Many of the people who saw the first Trinity test developed cancers. Richard Feynman, be a good example there. And many of them die in other ways as well. So you're right. Virgin Moroney dies relatively young from cancers. We know that many of the other pilots who went in on these, even if they were given a clean bit of health, and they did try and monitor them. I should point out they tried to limit the amount of exposure they get in Röntgens from these tests and put limits and things like that. But the reality is, when you are dealing with people who are flying into mushroom clouds, there is only so much safety you can do. It is always going to be an incredibly perilous profession to have for a job, fly into nuclear bomb. Unfortunately, many of them do develop cancers later in life, and there are many campaigns, not just from people who were involved in the testing, but also people who lived downwind, people who were located nearby, people who were forcibly moved and ejected from their homes so these tests could be carried out. And ultimately, I'm just glad we never actually used one of these things, mm-hmm. because if a thermonuclear bomb was ever used in anger, it is game over for all of us.
Because it gets to that point where the Russians with Tsar even scare themselves with these things, isn't it?
There's what's called the Tsar bomber, which is 70 megatons, I think it is, something ridiculous like that. There is no point for that weapon. I mean, they actually get to the point where they're saying, why are we even doing this? And there is a reason that we haven't developed nuclear bombs beyond the 1950s in terms of technology. There are obviously refinements. We now use lithium rather than deuterium, things like that. The simple answer is, it is the one thing in human history that we have got so good at, we have had to stop. Because there is no point making a better bomb.
I think that's a good place to wrap it up. Because what better way to say the futility of this, and the amount of people, because there's just been the recognition for the British nuclear test survivors as well. This is something that's living with us now.
This continues to this day. Living memory. And as I mentioned, Becky Miller, who's Robinson's daughter, she wasn't actually born when he died. Her mother was pregnant at the time. The other thing we often forget, these are young men. We're talking about men in their 20s doing this. which is just astonishing. But yeah, this is events that happened within living memory. There are people who witnessed Ivy Mike Test who are still alive today. And it's just, we can't afford to forget it ever.
Let's change tact a bit. What are you working on at the moment? Because that's all terribly exciting if you're allowed to talk about it. But pimp the books as well, because they're both great fun. And
thank you very much. So my first book is Super Heavy, which talks about why we're making things like plutonium. And obviously the story of I mentioned of americium and fermium is in there. But my particular interest is what's called the super heavy elements. So the ones we're making now and the ones we discovered just a couple of years ago, why are we still making elements? What are we trying to do there? And if you're interested in the science of the periodic table, it's a very niche but very interesting little book, I think. My second book is Racing Green, which is about technology in Formula One and other motorsports, particularly green technology and how these technologies have spiraled out from motorsport to help sustainability. I also look at things like how Formula One helped during the COVID-19 pandemic and helped save lives. And I'm currently working on a book that's sort of tracing back the origins of chemistry and alchemy all the way back to ancient Egypt and China and a bit beyond as well.
And if people want to learn more, what's the best way to keep updated with you, sir?
The best way is you can go to my website, which is the unoriginal kitchapman.co.uk, or you can follow me on Twitter at chemistrykit.
All the links will be in the description below. Kit, it has been too long. We need to meet up for a beer soon.
Absolutely.
And thank you so much for this. This has been fantastic. And the numbers weren't too big. I think I got it. I cannot thank Dr. Kit Chapman enough for joining us here on the Damcasters. I found that absolutely fascinating. And the steps that go into these world-ending devices, why do we have them? It's just, it blows my mind that these things are still around. Because when you look at the old footage of the tests, and I'm going to put the description to that rather mad documentary that the US Navy made in the description below, it's nuts. And it's cost so many people their lives, not just Jimmy Robinson. Yeah, it's not good. But buy Kit's books. They're great. Super Heavy and Racing Green are both superb. Links to them are in the description below, as his website and his Twitter. So do check him out and give him a follow, because he is fantastic fun. And like I said, one of the best communicators of science that I know. As we look into the future, I can only thank you for your continued support of the podcast. Things are going well. Our last episode with George Holt on the B-58, it's causing some controversy, but is going nuts on Instagram. So do check that out. If you'd like to support the pod, please like it, subscribe it. Put some stars into your podcast app of choice. Just tell your friends. It's going well. Our wonderful sponsors at the Pima Air and Space Museum are continuing with their support. We're going to be heading out there in the new year. So if you want something specific filmed, drop me a line, put a note in the.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Comments, and we can do that. Of course, if you want to join us on Patreon, become a Damcasteer, you can from just £3 a month, plus a spot of that. That all goes to help to keep these things going, paying for all of the stuff and microphones and things. But we know times are tough. Tell your friends. That's the best way to keep things going. So until next time, thank you ever so much for your support. You are all wonderful. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Do take care of yourselves. Bye-bye. The Damcasters is hosted and produced by Matt Bone and is a Boney Abroad podcast production. To learn more about our podcasts and check out our previous episodes, head to www.thedamcasterspod.com.